This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Hey, and welcome to this week's show. We got something fun for you. One of my favorite headliners in the history of laughs. This guy is an actor. He's a stand-up comic. You recognize him from over 20 appearances on television. He's done a few movies, TV commercials. But I personally respect him and know him as one of the best stand-up comics in the business. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Tom McTeague.
Wow.
And the crowd goes nuts. Good to have you here, Tom.
It's crazy. It's a huge crowd. I'm not used to crowds like this from Laughs Unlimited.
Ouch, starting right off the bat. You know, we have not talked in way too long, but we did work together a lot in the mid and late 80s and then into the 90s. And I meant every word I said when it comes to comedy headliners. You were definitely one of the best and one that always brought the crowds to their feet. And Jill and I were just talking about you the other day. There's bits that we still quote from 40 years later. But let's not jump ahead.
That makes me feel very, very good.
Oh.
I really appreciate it. Well, your room was really instrumental in my being able to step into stand-up comedy full-time. And I can tell you that story, or if you want to talk about something else.
Let me lead into it by just saying I know that you're at heart an actor. You were doing some acting before you got into comedy, and then after your stand-up career, you really took off as an actor. But tell the audience briefly how you went from doing some stage shows and plays and ended up in comedy.
I studied acting briefly in high school, and then when I went to college, I sort of stumbled into an acting program at Washington State University, and then moved to New York after my sophomore year and studied at HB Studios there, and then was living in Seattle. And at the time I lived in Seattle, I went through a relationship breakup, and was wandering around with my little broken heart in Seattle and discovered the Comedy Underground in Seattle. And,
oh, great club.
Yeah, and it was just magical because for the time that I was there, you know, the hour and a half that I was watching stand-up, I forgot about how sad I was, you know, and it was like alchemy. I couldn't believe it. And so I became enamored of the art form and started just palling around with comedians. I'd never considered myself a comic, but was just fascinated with comedy and comedians and
clubs, the industry.
And the whole thing. Yeah, so I was hired to do a traveling show that was and I don't exaggerate. It was the worst production ever put up. It was called Bloody Jack. And I think it was billed as a magical musical romp through the life of Jack the Ripper. It was just,
really?
It was so bad. So that was a stage show I was hired to do out of Seattle, and it went bankrupt in its first week or two. We played the Oakland Civic Auditorium for a paid audience of one. I think that's a 2,000 seat room.
Oh,
so this show goes bankrupt, and I am stuck in Oakland at a really nasty hotel in a really nasty neighborhood with the rest of the cast, and we're waiting for money to come. And there was a guy for money to come to get us back up to Seattle. And there was a guy in the cast. I don't know if you ever hired him or not. Howie Kirsten, did you ever hire him?
No, I don't even know the name. Was he a Bay Area entertainer? Okay.
No, he was a Seattle guy, but he was really funny. He was a member of the cast, and while we were waiting to get back up to Seattle, he would entertain us in this little piano bar attached to the hotel by singing funny songs. And I said, God, you're really funny. I know some comedians. I know a little bit about the comedy scene. I'll write for you, and you can do that on stage, and I'll manage you. And so we got back up to Seattle, and I was hustling and he was hustling, and we wound up getting him gigs around the Seattle area.
How cool.
And then on a dare, I had gotten into an argument with a local comedian. And I said, "Man, you're not funny." And he said, "Oh, I'm, you know," and he said, "You couldn't do it." And I said, I'll show you." So the next week I cobbled together, 5 minutes of Drek and bombed, but was hooked. And, that's how I got into stand-up comedy.
Wow. So do you remember what year that was?
I think it was 81, Scott. I'm not sure, but I think...
Early 80s. Because I know you didn't make it to laughs until the mid-80s. Now, how did you end up working for me? How did we meet?
So, the only booker... I mean, I was doing little road gigs like on Vancouver Island and in Canada. And then around the Seattle area. And the only, West Coast booker was John... Fox out of San Francisco, who owned the Comedy Underground or booked the Comedy Underground, and then also had a room in Lake Tahoe and then the Punchline in San Francisco.
Yeah, John was a definite booker at the time. We crossed paths a few times.
Yeah, and I guess he also had a room in Sunnyvale. So having worked in Seattle, I wound up getting, I don't know whether they were middle gigs or opening gigs from him, and I was in my car. I drove my car and I'd park it outside of whatever town he'd hired me to be in. And I'd just pitch a tent in a campground, shower in the campground showers, and then drive into town and do the gig. And
wow. Life on the road, not luxurious.
Yeah, right? and so I was close to Sacramento, and I knew there was a club in Sacramento, and I popped in to your club. I think Denny Johnston was working that evening, and Denny and I had met in Seattle, and I said, "Hey, I'm here. I'd like to do a guest set." And very graciously, you allowed me to do a guest set, and I punched it. So you said, "Hey, if you want, I think you initially hired me to middle, maybe to open, but I think you hired me to middle and gave me like 4 weeks. And I was like, "Oh my God, this is great."
Yeah, I had multiple clubs and I was able to offer comics because I like to bring people back so they got a reputation in the town. And you probably were a feature act because I'm embarrassed to say that by the late 80s, especially, I was doing so much time. I got rid of the opening acts and just had features and headliners.
You did. You were so tedious. You just kept doing the same thing every single, and you wouldn't get off. You'd go, "Hey, yeah, no, I need 45 minutes from you." And then by the time you got off, there was no time left. It was like, just wore the crowd out. Well, you enjoyed it. It was your club. Do whatever you want, But you were famous. I don't know if you know that. You were pretty famous among comedians for eating up a whole lot of stage time.
The club owner that took up stage time. That's a nice reputation to have.
Well, if it's your club, right? Who's going to argue with you?
Well, was great having you come into the club, and I didn't remember how you got started, but boy, our relationship really took off. You were one of our go-to guys, and you always wowed the audiences. You were a great writer.
Well, thank you. I loved stand-up. I still love it, but the life of traveling from town to town and doing shows and sleeping in condos or hotels or, it just wears on you.
It's a tough life.
There are guys who can do it. And I think still do it to a degree, but it just wears you down. And so I did stand up. I don't know. I would say a couple of weeks out of every month. And at some point there, I transitioned in 86. I think I transitioned down to LA from Seattle. And then I'd do a couple of weeks on the road, and then I'd stay home for a couple of weeks and audition. And then I'd go back out on the road, and then I'd audition.
Because your heart was really with acting. That was your pedestal that you leapt from. You always wanted to be, in your heart of hearts, was an actor, which is interesting because a lot of stand-up comics start off in stand-up and wanted or ended up being actors. and you were kind of an actor that ended up being a stand-up. You're almost the opposite of what most of the guys did.
Well, it was a little bit of a hybrid, and I don't know that I was that my heart was always in acting. I mean, I really adored.
You had a lot of success in the 90s, buddy.
Well, I did. Yeah, I mean, I got very fortunate, but you know, I think that there were always guys who were looking at stand up as a vehicle to get a sitcom, and I would probably fall into that. You know, I mean, I was hoping for sitcom fame or, you know, more of whatever, but I really loved stand up just for itself. I mean, it was so immediate, and it was totally controlled by you, the artist. You know, you could say what you want and do what you want and shape it the way you wanted it to be, and there were no other hands in the pie, you know.
And the instant gratification is really important. I mean, as an actor, you'll go out in front of a camera and it may not air for months, and then it's edited and you really don't know what it's going to come out to be. And when you're live on stage, good or bad, you know it.
Yeah, there's nobody to blame, and there's nobody to share the victory with. You know, it's yours, and it's really cool. You know, I mean, it's very addicting, and I've always, you know, always done stand up from the time I started. To this day, I've been watching my schedule sort of fall apart. I don't know if it'll come back or not for me. I mean, I we were talking a little bit ago about the tedium of road life and travel, and it's, you know, the older you get, the more you hate going through customs and security and getting on planes and leaving your home. And, well, you know, I've got two dogs, a cat, three kids and a wife, you know, I mean, my life is here.
It's full.
And to be away from all of that just to me doesn't seem to be worth it much anymore. I love going to Vegas for a week or two a year, but I don't know if I'll pick up on ships again or not. We'll see.
Well, let's get back to, we've kind of jumped ahead. Let's go back to your beginnings, because you were very popular in the club. You had, what was interesting is where you had Seinfeld talking about common things, and you had Larry Miller, who was the long story guy. He could tell a story over a half an hour and you'd be laughing all the way through it at different points. You were somewhere in between, again, kind of a hybrid, but you had great stories. And I was alluding to it earlier. Jill and I still talk every time we see a motorcycle gang. It's a motor scooter gang.
The Hell's Angels from France. Yeah.
And then the pot pie bit. I'm not saying that right. Pot pie. And then one of our favorite closes of all time had to be your bit that ended up, I was wondering how you loaded that thing.
Oh my God. That's so funny. That wasn't even mine. That's like an old joke. And I think I learned that joke about loading the dick in the glass of milk. I think I got that joke from Playboy Party Jokes.
No.
Yes.
It fits so well on the whole bit you did about burning your chubby and everything. It was hilarious.
Yeah, I dressed it up. But I mean, in Playboy Party Jokes, it was a guy that went into the doctor or something and said, I burnt my, I don't know how it was working.
Oh, that's so funny. I always thought you wrote that.
Yeah. No, it's an old joke, it just worked into a closer, and apparently not enough people read the jokes in Playboy Party Jokes for anybody to call me out on it. But yeah, that was an old Playboy Party joke.
Hey, well, you made it yours, and that was what counted. Now I know that the pot pie bit and a few others made it on an album you did, but you had a number of. What I was trying to kind of make clear to the audience was that there's some comics that just do joke, and there's others that tell, they're more of a monology and tell stories. And you were kind of a hybrid in the middle and always very entertaining, never had any trouble filling time. Now, if you started off as a feature for me, did it feel like it took a while to get enough time to headline?
No. I think that happened probably within a year or at the very outside too, with you. I was always really aggressive because the money was in the headline spot, you know, and I was always looking at it as a means of supporting myself. So if it was the headline spot that paid the bigger bucks, then that's the spot I wanted. And I wasn't trying to be a dick about it, but I always made a very conscious decision if I was middling to make it a very difficult act to follow.
You know, nothing wrong with that.
And at some point, you know, I mean, even really great headliners, whether it was, you know, Jeff Altman or Denny or, you know, any of the guys that were headlining at that time, they didn't want to follow me. You know, it's no fun. It's no fun watching somebody beat up a room for 30 minutes and then you get up and have to change the pace in order to follow them.
And try to make it your room. Right. Right. But it does. Yeah. It does happen. And that just shows the quality of a good, solid headliner, which you end up becoming. You could follow anybody, I felt, once you got to that point. You worked at the club for a number of years. Do you have any stories from the laughs days?
God, there's a ton of stories. There was one, and I remember it. I hope I'm remembering this well. I believe I was in the green room, and Mac and Jamie were there, and we were sharing stories, and Mac was a little thrown because a woman had come back into the green room and was talking to them, and she had unzipped her pants in the green room and pulled them down, not to expose her vagina, but she had right above her pubis, she had two nipples, and she was thanking them because she had gone through a mastectomy, a double mastectomy, and they had saved her nipples by sewing them onto her down by her pubis, right? And I remember being in the green room, and Jamie was, his eyes were just like as big as saucers. He goes, "You wouldn't believe what that woman just did."
You know,
because I saw her, you know.
It's so funny. And now that you mention the story, and that's a great story. I remember that story, but I totally had forgotten it. But what a bizarre thing to do. And at the same time, if you're going through cancer and a mastectomy, makes perfect sense that you'd want to save something for the reconstruction. That's a wild story.
So they saved them there. And then I guess when she had her reconstruction, they put them back where they were supposed to be. But she was thanking them because the way she got through chemo and the whole removal and reconstruction of her breast was attending comedy shows. And Mac and Jamie, I think, were her favorite act or one of her favorite acts. And she just wanted to express her joy to them. But I always thought, oh my God, that, you know, when somebody unzips their pants, you don't expect to see nipples unless they're really old.
Yeah.
You
know, that's so funny. Though that's a great story.
Yeah. And then, I was there so often, Scott. I think I did the downtown club twice or three times a year. And I think I did Citrus Heights two or three times a year. So I was up there six times a year anyway. I had a lot of people that I knew up in the area and had a lot of fun. But, you know, they're the run-of-the-mill stand-up comedy during the 80s, early 90s stories of,
well,
you know, an awful lot of fun.
But we used to do things. I mean, I know you used to be an avid water skier. I think we took you out skiing once on the boat. And I don't know if you ever made any of the bowling nights, but we used to have some fun away from the club. And I know that we always enjoyed having you in town. So I'm sure that you were a part of some of that.
Well, I remember doing that. And that's true. You guys did a really good job of making the club sort of a familial place. You were adamant that nobody got to sleep with your waitresses. That was like a bridge that you couldn't cross, which, you know, on the one hand, you're like, it was annoying. But on the other hand, it worked out really well because you could come back and there wasn't any, you know, you hadn't left any dirt behind. You know what I mean?
That's interesting. We did it for the protection of both the comics and the wait staff at the, it's been mentioned a couple times on the podcast. We had a younger staff, mostly women, and we were told by the comics that guided us through the opening. It was people like Saget and Shandling and stuff. They were the ones that said, protect your staff, because as you point out, you don't want to poison the water. If you're going to have somebody come back over and over and over and they get involved, it makes it muddies everything and it's not as clean. And so there was many reasons. It was called rule number 8. It was kind of famous. Rule number 8, no messing with the staff. And I heard after the fact that it rule number 8 had gotten broken a few times, but overall it was there for a reason and it did its job.
Yeah, I think it probably got broken a few times, but there were clubs that I'd go to that, I mean, it was like a buffet. You know, the staff was there with the implicit knowledge that the comics were theirs to pick up, and the comics knew that the waitresses were there to pick up, and it was those clubs lasted a long, long time, and I don't think there were any big problems from it. But I'm sure that, you know, you'd go into town, and if you'd been with a waitress, and you know, then you were with a different waitress or a different, you know, and
Now, you mentioned that you worked with Denny and a few of the guys. Was there anybody in the business you really looked up to or liked working with?
I loved working with Denny, but I remember, I think I was at the other club, or I don't know where I was. Maybe I just dropped in on a night Denny was there. He and I worked together so many times, and I knew his act. It lasted 37 minutes, and it was exactly
It never changed.
And I mean, back in those days, you'd watch the other comic and they'd go, I got a tag for you, or I've got this line for you. You could try to take this bit that way. And I remember giving Denny what I thought were really, really good, solid tags. And he would always go, oh, yeah, that's perfect. That's great. Oh, man, thank you. And then you'd watch him and he wouldn't put it in. He'd do the exact same 37 minutes. And the whole time, I mean, from the time before I was even a comic and just watching stand up, Denny's 37 minutes didn't change an iota. The same.
Luckily, it was a funny 37 minutes, but it was
good.
But he never changed it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you go on YouTube, you can hear Denny's, I don't know, there's a little bit of videotape of Denny from those days, but God, he was brilliant. And so I loved working with him. I loved working with Dana Carvey, Kevin Pollak. Kevin was a real mensch to me when I first moved to LA. He really opened a lot of doors for me, just because he treated me like a friend, like a peer, and because he had the reputation he had, he was able to, you know, get me late night spots at the Improv. And once I got a spot and got seen, then they'd give me better spots. So he opened that door for me. And then Jeff Altman opened the door to commercials for me, because he was represented at William Morris and said, oh, I'll put in a good word for you. You got a good look and I bet you could do it. So he got me in at William Morris.
Yeah, it's really neat. You mentioned Kevin Pollak. He was one of those guys that was a terrific stand-up comic, but quickly went into acting and never stopped, still going today. And Jeff Altman was one of those guys that didn't do a lot of acting, but he was very popular and did concerts and shows and TV a lot. But it's interesting how they each were able to take you down a different path, and how lucky for you to make those connections. That worked out really well for you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I've been able to, you know, smooth the way for guys that came after me. But it was a really neat time. It was such a young industry. There had been the Playboy circuit prior to, you know, clubs, and then the Catskills and you know, supper clubs prior to that. But comedy clubs, you know, where you had, you know, the MC, the middle act, and the headliner was a pretty new phenomenon in the early 80s. And boy, it was so much fun to be a part of. It was just a blast.
Yeah, and that's kind of the reason for this podcast. I felt like we were really lucky to share that part of our lives. The 80s and the 90s, in my case, were particularly strong. And I felt that was kind of the golden age of stand-up. And you say golden age, people think oldies. But it really was when, if you were a talented writer and you worked the job, it was work. You had to write, and you had to perform, and you had to go through the trials and tribulations and the sacrifices of being on the road. But if you were good and consistent, you could become famous. And in your case, it led to more acting. We should mention to the audience that you were a regular on Baywatch in the early 90s, right? You did a lot of shows like Beverly Hills 90210, Roseanne, several, I think over 20 TV appearances in the early 90s. And then you ended up doing a few movies. Quite a career, Tom. Congratulations.
Well, thanks. It was never the career that I had envisioned it was going to be. My wheelhouse in terms of income and in terms of longevity and mass work was commercials. And I wound up, I think I tried to tally it up one time, and I had something like 385 national network commercials.
Oh, really? That many? That'll make a living.
Yeah, it was great. And I mean, at one time in the probably early 90s, maybe late 80s, but probably early 90s, I had 22 national network ads airing at the same time.
That's incredible.
And I remember watching the NBA finals one year, and on a commercial break, all the commercials were my commercials.
Oh, no way. Yeah. That's
three
man.
In a row.
And you made money.
Boom, boom, boom. Oh, yeah.
Just exposure. That's great money.
No, it's wonderful. And so commercials really were what I really won at. I had a couple of television sitcom pilots and a couple of, you know, a number of guest star roles and then a couple of films. But the real, at least financial success, came out of just doing commercial after commercial after commercial. And I was fortunate to look the way I look, you know, and I was able to sell, but I was in the right demographic too. Right.
Right. Right.
So I was
age.
Able to sell everything from, you know, from beer commercials, like the young single guy look, to the young married dad look. And that transitioned into the middle dad look. And, you know, and commercials were really lucrative at that point. They weren't, that whole business has totally changed now. I have no idea how people make a living at it, because nobody watches commercials.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, commercials are nothing now.
Well,
I
want to share with you that Jill was just saying right before I called you that, and we saw it actually on one of those like best commercials ever TV shows, but there's one where you were doing a car company and you're racing your child on a tricycle and you're in the car. She thought it was for Volkswagen.
Yeah, it was Volkswagen, and the kid, I forget his last name, was Angus. He was the kid on Two and a Half Men.
No.
Yeah. Oh,
well, that commercial still is, to Jill, is one of the most endearing. The look and the way you came across in that commercial is the young dad racing as, you know, you're in the car and the son's in the tricycle. People out there in podcast land, if you envision this, you'll probably remember the commercial. It did run a ton. But it was so sweet and so funny kind of at the same time. She's never forgotten and still thinks it's one of the highlights of your career.
it was a really sweet commercial, you know. And he was great, and the directors were great. I'm trying to remember Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Ferris. They're a husband and wife directing team. They did... I'm not sure what their whole IMDb is, but they were the directors of Little Miss Sunshine. You remember that?
Oh, yeah. Very successful. So
they directed that ad. But God, I got to work with some brilliant directors, you know, I mean, cinematographers. I did a number of spots with Yanis Kaminsky, who is the cinematographer for most of Spielberg's stuff. He did Schindler's List and a number of other ones, and and Bob Richardson, who was the director of The Aviator. I mean, there were really, really good directors, and in between films, they do commercials, and I got to work with some of the best. It was a lot of fun.
What a great career, and it's interesting because I've already interviewed at least a dozen comics, and I'm planning to interview more, and I got to say, Tom, you're probably the only one that was able to make an income and a living from TV commercials on top of all your success as a stand-up comic. And of course you did, I'm sure you made some money on Baywatch and a few of those shows, but the idea that commercials was really the pinnacle and supported you, I think is a, you know, it just shows that show business has a lot of different avenues.
Yeah, there were, I mean, within my, I guess the balls that I juggled at that point were stand up, commercials, voiceover, and legitimate, whether it was TV or film. So all those balls were what I was juggling in order to make a career out of it. And so when any, you know, one or two of those wasn't in the air, the other ones were, and they were sort of pulling the financial train. So I was really lucky to have, you know, really good representation. Man, I had the best commercial agents. I had the best theatrical agents. I was lucky enough to land a lot of big campaigns, whether they were on-air campaigns or voiceover campaigns. And then, and that lasted pretty much through, I would say, through the 90s. It was really flush. And then, you know, age and the business changed a little bit and it got a little bit slower, but it was still a good living through the first part of the 2000s. But then it just started getting really slow. And around that time was when I moved to Texas. And, you know, and when I moved here, it was really like, all right, it's over, you know. And oddly enough, within a year of winding up in Texas, I landed the biggest voiceover campaign of my career, just auditioning out of my closet in my house.
Well, you were also a pro, so that helped.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, voiceover is one of those things where you just audition into the ether. You know, you read for these things and send off the MP3s, and you most often never hear back. You know, nobody says, good job, it was close, it's down to you and the other guy. You just never hear.
Now,
you know,
what was that for, Tom?
A company called Bojangles. It's a chicken firm like Popeyes or Church's or Kentucky Fried Chicken. They've got about 500 stores up and down the East Coast. But I had that campaign for radio and TV, just The Voice, for 9 years.
Wow.
And I probably did 20 spots for them a month.
That's incredible, Tom. That's a paycheck.
Yeah, it was brilliant. And then at some point I was here and got an audition for Boyhood. And you know, it wasn't even called Boyhood. It was just I think it was called the 12-year project or something like that.
We should tell people you're referencing the movie you were in 2014, or that's when it was released.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was a really good movie, and it won the Golden Globe. It was nominated for Best Picture in the Academy Awards. It was this amazing film that turned into, you know, a very worthy project. But at the time I auditioned for it, it had already been filming for 7 years, right? It follows a boy from the time he's 8 until he's 18. And so it had already been filming for 7 years, and I just went into it thinking, Christ, nothing films for 7 years. This is a vanity project, and
right,
it's never going to, you know, it's never going to see the light of day. So I went in and I did my part and didn't think much about it. And then a year or two later, when it got released, it started getting all this buzz, and it was probably the highest profile thing in my career, you know. And
congratulations.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun, you know, and it's a nice, if that's the last big media thing I do, it's a nice tip of my hat to the business.
Well, exactly. And I do want to bring this all back to comedy. So how would you feel that being a stand-up comic and the successful headliner you were, did it help you in negotiating some of these other projects that you did in the 90s and 2000s that were more acting? But I'm sure your experience on stage and your quality of writing and your personality had to have been shaped somewhat by those years on stage.
Not negotiating in terms of contracts, but negotiating just getting around the part or getting through the audition, that sort of negotiating. Is that what you're talking about?
No, I meant the experience. You know, I hate to sound hotty-totty, but one of the reasons I'm doing this podcast is I think there's a real art form to stand up. There's a talent, there's some immediate reaction from a crowd. You have to really work at it. There's a lot of sacrifice. You have to be able to write and be creative. You can't steal. And you were able to do all that in the 80s. And I was just curious if some of the lessons you learned as a comic and in the world of comedy, did it bridge over to your acting and offer you any foundation for your future?
I think absolutely. You know, I mean, it's all of it is intertwined, but the stand-up comedy gives you this opportunity to stand in front of a room full of strangers and have to be fearless. You just sort of step out into the void and you start entertaining them. And so the experience that I gained from stand-up was invaluable in auditioning. You know, you'd walk into a room and it was just a room with, you know, maybe 5 or 6 or 10 people in it. But it was my job to entertain them, whether it was my script and ad-libbing or their script. You know, it was pretty easy for me to hold their attention and make that an enjoyable process for them, too. And I think that's oftentimes what lands you the part. People go, oh, man, remember that guy who came out and did that thing? You know,
right. And I think it gives you a confidence.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, I used to forget auditions. I mean, I'd go in and at the height, I was probably doing 5 a day.
Yikes.
You know, you'd have a suit in your car and you'd have jeans in your car and you'd have a t-shirt and a button down shirt. And, you know, you'd go from one to the other and change in the car, in the parking lot when you got to the next audition. And I remember early, I'd tell my mom I auditioned for, I don't know, Folgers or whatever it was. And then the next time I talked to her, she goes, so, honey, did you get that Folgers audition? And, you know, I didn't remember it got to a point where it's like, I'm not even going to tell my mom that I've auditioned for anything because she remembers all of them, right?
Right, and she's looking for you.
Yeah, but if you're not, if you're thinking about the audition you had 2 weeks ago, you know, and hoping that the phone's going to ring, God, that's a painful existence because the phone mostly doesn't ring, you know?
But
so you
doing
go
those
in, you
five.
Do what you do, you forget about it. And then, you know, I got to a point where I knew I'd booked stuff pretty much walking out of the audition.
And doing 5 a day, you were paying your dues in the acting business. Now, I have to tell you, Tom, I don't know anything about the acting business except what I've seen on TV and movies. And they always make it sound look like a real grunge. You got to really dig it out and, like you said, do auditions and sit back and wait for the phone to ring. But it sounds like you took advantage of being able to make a living as a comic and still go out and showcase and do auditions. And that really gave you the opportunities that led to your success.
Well, I think it did. And I think it did on a number of different levels, because when you've got a livelihood, you know, which stand up was very, you know, it was very lucrative. You know, if you worked it, you could make a lot of money doing it. So I didn't need the commercials and I didn't need the jobs that I was auditioning for to pay my rent, you know, which gives you a certain degree of ambivalence. Hire me or don't hire me, but don't give me shit. You know,
gives you the freedom to say no.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not trying to be crass, but it's a little bit of fuck you money, you know? So I found myself a number of times, and I don't remember specifics, but I was in a situation where people were being just kind of rude. And I was able to just say, man, you're just being rude. I don't want this job. See ya. And walk out.
Good for you. Well, I'm glad comedy gave you that base. So I want to share with the audience one of your sets, and I'm going to put that on at the end of this. We were lucky enough to work with you many, many times over the years, and we were able to capture some of that on video and audio recordings that we made from the club. I've actually already aired some of your material in other podcasts, but I have lots of it.
When does the check arrive from that, Scott?
Well, as soon as there's any money in it for me, buddy, you're on the list. This is a labor of love, trust me. But I just wanted to say that thank you, not only for doing the podcast, but for also being a major part of the success of Laughs Unlimited. The years in the mid and late 80s and into the early 90s that you were performing regularly at all of my clubs really helped substantiate Laughs Unlimited as a major comedy club in the country. And the fact that it's lasted 40 years and guys like us can get on the phone and talk like we just saw each other a week ago and it's been 20 years is pretty incredible. So I appreciate you taking the time and sharing some of your experiences with me today.
Well, you're more than welcome. It's been a real pleasure hearing your voice and getting to catch up a little bit. And I think I owe you thanks as well. You know, thanks for running a club and running it well and paying people on time and being an honorable businessman and providing a venue for me and countless other comedians to apply their craft. You know, I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun to work at Laughs, and I'm glad you're doing well. Give Jill a hug for me. I haven't seen either of you, like you say, in way too long, but I hold you both in very high esteem.
Well, thanks a lot, Tom, and you as well. Thank you. That was really sweet to say, and as I said, you stand out as one of the guys that really made a difference. So let's introduce the audience to some of your material. Tom, it's been great chatting with you. I'm glad that I'm just proud of all the success you've had. It's just incredible, your career, and it sounds like it's continuing. Is there any projects you're working on or that you're going to be looking forward to in the next year or so?
I have absolutely no plans. I'm like a trapdoor spider now. I don't look very hard for work, but if it stumbles by, I tend to jump out and grab it.
Oh, that's a that's a great analogy. Great picture. All right. Well, tell you what, ladies and gentlemen, sit back and relax. Enjoy some great stand-up comedy from one of the best headliners I ever had the pleasure of working with. Tom, thanks for doing the podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, here's some material live on stage. Tom McTeague. Thanks, buddy.
July, celebrating America's independence from Great Britain. Before, you've got to be careful, because apparently now, every single year on the 4th of July, more people are killed and wounded by fireworks than were killed and wounded during the entire period of the Revolutionary War. I got a buddy who lives in England. He's very cocky and goes, "Well, if we had bottle rockets and whistling pigs, we'd have won that war." No, you wouldn't. Might have won the war if you didn't wear red in the woods. It is the military blunder of all time. Look at me, I'm camouflaged. Try on the bush. Big red bush. Shiny gold batteries. Have to be invisible. No, you're not invisible. Oh, God, I've been shot. Who would shoot that bush? It's creepy. It's stupid. It's not like I've been bushwhacked. I should tell that joke on a cruise a while back. There's a British couple in the audience. The woman got right in my face after the show. She goes, "You're anything to British shit, you British do." What the right on? Hey, it was a Revolutionary War joke. Too soon?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was the stand-up comedy of Tom McTeague. I know you enjoyed that. Thanks so much to Tom for doing our podcast and sharing his comedy and writing talents from back in the 80s and 90s. Ladies and gentlemen, please tell your friends about the podcast, share it, rate it, get it out there, and Again, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, Your Host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.